ACEC is excited to announce that registration is now open for its fall conference taking place in Marco Island, Florida, this October. That's right, after a year of Zoom and virtual meetings, we're excited to be bringing our fall conference back as an in-person event. And we can't tell you how excited we are to look forward to seeing you there in person for all of the content, networking, and education that the fall conference is known for. Log on to www.acec.org for more information. We can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to the Private Markets Update on the Engineering Influence Podcast presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies. Last week, ACEC released our latest private industry brief, which provides practical detailed information and targeted market insights on key AE private sectors. This issue focused on energy and utilities and provides a lot of data on the current state and future prospects for the sector. I encourage you to read the brief. It's available for free download on the ACEC website, and there's a link in the show notes. To dive a little deeper into the numbers and analysis, Aaron McLaughlin, ACEC Vice President for Private Market Resources, is back on the program. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Jerry.
So in reading the brief, I was surprised how large this market is. You say it's estimated to be about $31 billion annually for engineering firms. And it's also very broad with a lot of sectors involved. What, is this a really key market for our members?
It absolutely is. So as you all know, I've divided up the very broad, huge private market into four sub-markets that we analyze our briefs in. So, you know, we've combined energy and utilities into one market. And so what we're sort of analyzing within that are oil and gas companies, as well as electric, gas, and water utilities. So, you know, it's a very critical market for our members. These are obviously critical clients for our grid and for what we need in life, utilities and power. And certainly the client base also takes up a lot of land. You know, it's a very much a vertical market, even though it's private. So there's always been lots of opportunity to do quite a bit of surveying, mapping, permitting, a lot of those sort of projects that you even see with highway and roadway projects. Those services also can be very applicable and very similar when you're looking at utility clients as well. So, you know, in the US, most utilities are what our engineering firms consider private clients, with the exception of some water utilities. And I know we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the podcast. But again, you know, electric and gas companies, oil and gas companies at all different sort of levels of the process are pretty key clients for our industry.
And is it a steady market? Is it sort of just a, you know, in investing, they always talk about investing in utilities. That's a basic slow growth value. Right. Is it the same way in this market?
Yeah, it's absolutely a very steady market. I think what's very interesting is, you know, we do our briefs on an annual basis, and some briefs, market trends do not change dramatically. I think if you look back at the energy and utility markets, it's a very steady market and has very steady growth. But what makes up that market and the kind of energy sources and how that translates to the kind of work our member firms are doing is changing. So for example, you know, a decade or so ago, maybe even a little bit longer, many of our firms were hot to get into the natural gas play. So you saw a lot of firms go up to Pennsylvania and Ohio, maybe grow their operations down in Texas, and really get into that shale and the natural gas play. And now, you know, if you read a brief, well, we weren't doing them 10 years ago, but if you read a brief from 10 years ago, it would talk about that, you know, and now we're really seeing a dramatic shift, even just within the last few years, on renewables being such a big part of the energy mix. And so the kind of work that our firms are being called upon to do in that market space is different. You know, the project types are different because the energy sources and the energy mix is different.
Well, speaking of renewables, in the brief, you call them the bright spot in over the past year, and they're forecast to account for about 70% of the utility scale additions in this year. Do you expect them to sustain that pace?
We do. So what's very interesting, we use a lot of different sources in our materials for the brief. You know, two main sources are the domestic U.S. Energy Information Administration, or the EIA, and then we also use the International Energy Agency, which is the IEA. So it's very confusing when you're using all the same three letters all the time, but basically domestic, international. And they are a little bit different because we also obviously have different energy policies than other countries. But our energy policy has definitely been driving us to a greener economy, more of a net zero economy. So as a result of that, our mix of energy has to include more renewables. So, you know, like with a lot of different industries, during the pandemic caused recession, there was a slowdown. And so less energy was being used. You know, think of all the office buildings downtown that are a little darker still even. Think of all the people that didn't drive to work. So your oil and your gas market changed, airplanes, you know. So a lot of the market did quiet down quite a bit during the pandemic and hasn't necessarily returned. But some of the markets have returned. And so one of the markets that was very strong during and grew, one of the only markets that even grew within the last couple of years, was that renewables market. And renewables inform electricity and inform the electrical grid. And we are still using electricity. We're all home Zooming. We have more devices than ever. Some of us may have electric cars. So the electricity sector is still growing, and the need for renewables to be a main part of that electricity generation continues. And so that market, you know, the domestic EIA expects in 2021 that that will be 70% of the utility scale addition, certainly. And then EIA actually projects all the way out to 2050. And that is the, when you combine solar and wind in particular, that those are, that's the fastest growing segment. So in 2020, it made up about 21% of electricity generation, but by 2050, it's expected to make up 42%. So that's almost doubling in the next just under 30 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reason for that is what we call out in one of our five trends in the brief, is that all these different states are setting very aggressive net zero and carbon-free energy goals. So for example, California, which we know can be very progressive on these things, wants to be 100% carbon-free electricity by 2045. You know, that's just over 20 years away. And how are they gonna get there? They're gonna get there through solar and wind, you know, contributing the most to those renewables to their electricity generation.
And I would imagine California being on the West Coast, that's going to bring in the offshore wind as well. And you focus on that briefly in the brief about that it's really picking up.
Yes. So offshore wind picking up is one of our five trends. And again, this is really where you really see a big difference between what's happening now to even just a few years ago. So when you look at the states that are setting these more aggressive targets coming up, most of them are on the West, all three on the West Coast of our continental US, Washington, Oregon, and California have set aggressive goals. And then of course, many on the East Coast from North Carolina, particularly up to New England, are setting aggressive goals. And they really can't get there without that renewable energy source. So it's interesting, at the map on page 4 of our brief, we list the top 5 states in each sector, solar, wind, and natural gas. And right now, the top 5 states producing wind are all in the Midwest and down in the lower plains. So we have Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas as our top 5 wind states. And I would not be surprised if in a couple of years, when we do this map again, it's on the left and right coasts. And that's really because that's where that, you know, renewable energy has to come from in order to meet those targets from those states. So there's also, of course, other reasons. There's been certain tax incentives at both federal and state levels to get some of these development projects off the ground. And it's just very, very interesting. And it's really happening right now. So there's an 800 megawatt Vineyard wind project off the coast of Massachusetts. It's the first commercial scale facility to win a federal construction permit earlier this year. So we're at the very beginning of this, and we're going to see it continue most likely over the next couple decades.
I've seen pictures of some of these offshore turbines that in relation to, say, a ship a good sized ship. These things are humongous.
They're huge. They're huge. And it's a different kinds of engineering that go into siting, permitting, helping the design and the build process of these kinds of structures that are absolutely huge and way out in the ocean. Yeah.
And then you need the connection to the mainland.
You need the connection. So that's right. Actually trend number four. Uh-huh. And so focus on transmission improvements. And that's actually a part of what's in the infrastructure package, hopefully that will pass as well. You know, we've done a great job collectively as a society in coming up with a lot of new technologies, including, you know, solar and wind have advanced quite a bit. However, getting that energy that is produced back into the grid and transmitted ultimately to customers and users is still a bit of a old school wonky process. And I'm not going to go deep into it because frankly, I'm not an expert in that area, but there's definitely going to be market opportunities for us improving the grid so that these renewable energy sources, particularly offshore wind, can get to where they need to be. And then along with that, besides the actual transmission, is battery storage and sort of improving how we store energy so that it can also be held and transmitted for use.
Well, since we've hit on four of the trends, we might as well hit the fifth one, which was the potential impact of energy, social, and governance, ESG services, something I never heard of, but right. could you go into that?
Well, this is going to be a big deal. So we actually recently had our Water Energy, ACEC's Water Energy and Environment Committee meeting, which is led by our government affairs group, Lynn, and we had a presentation by the person at the US Chamber that's in charge of tracking ESG. And I must say our audience, our small audience, our committee was very surprised at what's coming up, as were we. So basically, President Biden has put forth an executive order directing federal officials in major federal contracts to disclose risks and develop climate risk strategies, aka ESG plans. At the same time, so that's for federal agencies, federal contractors. At the same time, the Securities and Exchange Commission has put out some potential rulemaking language in the Federal Register and out there that even though right now it's very much not a requirement, but is suggested and is being driven by a lot of boards of public companies that eventually, and it could be eventually could be very soon, it could be a requirement for publicly traded firms to produce ESG as part of their disclosures and their quarterly and annual plans and commit and show how they're going to commit to being contributing to a clean energy economy. So, you know, this has a lot of what I would say impact and opportunity for our member firms. The impact is if you're a federal contractor, if you're a publicly held company, or if you're in a supply chain of a federal contractor or publicly held company, you may have to start producing ESG documentation and that sort of thing on yourself, on your own company. At the same time, all of the companies, maybe not even within our industry, that have to do this need help. They need to measure, you know, their ESG. They have to quantify and qualify what they're doing. And they're going to be looking to firms to help them with that. And many of our large firms are already putting together and have already started marketing those services to clients. So, you know, there's an opportunity there for us to work with all sorts of client types and industries in producing ESG documentation. And at the same time, there is a potential, I hate to say, to use the word, but a burden, or what will seem a burden at the beginning, to do that for ourselves. So, you know, we're keeping a very close eye on that and we'll be watching that. And I expect that we will see lots more activity around that in 2022.
That sounds like it might be the subject of a future podcast. It's a big enough issue.
Yeah. And I do believe our research institute is going to be holding a roundtable discussion on that later this year. So anyone listening to this podcast, please check back to the research institute. Keep an eye out. We're going to have a roundtable discussion on that soon as well.
Perfect. And in less than a week now, the House is expected to vote on the infrastructure bill. You highlight that this sector does very well in the infrastructure bill. How so?
Well, yes. So I've outlined a Senate bipartisan version, which obviously will be tweaked. And hopefully most of this will still be included. But, you know, when you break out what is inside that bipartisan version that is connected to the energy and utilities market, we see that the power and grid are allocated $65 billion. And tied with that is broadband at $65 billion. So broadband as a market or as a client type is not a is not necessarily considered a utility here in the US. Generally, folks are receiving broadband at their homes or at their businesses through ISPs or through perhaps cable companies. And because of the push for particularly rural broadband, we are seeing changes in that market. And that's a market that will really impact families and people that are working remotely from home, perhaps still doing school from home. And obviously everybody's streaming a lot more on the internet. So very interesting. I would say if you ask me what the biggest surprise was, it's that broadband is getting as much money as power and grid. Now, all of that broadband allocation is not going to the physical deployment of broadband necessarily. There are more social elements in that sort of bucket of money. But I do think that that's a very interesting thing that, that we are also tracking and keeping an eye on. And interestingly enough, it is electric cooperatives that are tagged to receive potentially a lot of that money. And just like those electric cooperatives electrified the rural US back in the early and mid 20th century, you know, those are the kinds of companies that may receive sort of the grants or the loans from the federal government to deploy that kind of rural broadband. So I encourage our listeners, our business development folks, to keep an eye on the electric cooperatives as probably good clients that might get more funding in that area. Now back to the power and grid. So a lot of that money is going to be tagged for grid reliability and resiliency. And you know, we saw what happened in Texas last winter, and we see what happens when we have major storms and events in the US that our grid is not as reliable as it needs to be. So that is a big piece of it. And then the other big piece of that $65 billion is going to be directed towards clean energy, carbon capture, and energy efficiency. And certainly, you know, the reasons for that is, again, to try to meet these clean energy goals that a lot of the states have laid out.
That's a lot of buckets of money.
It's a lot of buckets of money.
So one other sort of focus that you have in the brief is the private water market. It's right. A growing market. I'll admit to having some discomfort with the whole concept, yeah. You know, that putting the profit motive into something that people need to live. But regardless, it looks like it's here to stay and it's growing.
Well, it's interesting. So when I look at the market in totality, energy and utilities, obviously, as most of our member firms know, you work for your utility clients here in the Mid-Atlantic. It would be Pepco, which is an Exelon company, which I think I have ranked as the largest electric utility, or your Washington Gas, or, you know, if you're here in rural Virginia, as where I'm sitting right now, my electric bill is to the Shenandoah Valley Electric Cooperative. So, you know, these are all quote unquote private clients, but most engineering firms, when they work on their water wastewater clients, they are public, they're municipal, controlled by water authorities and controlled by usually within the county or the local jurisdiction that people are in. However, there hasn't been a lot of tracking of this, but a couple different reports that I was able to analyze, one by the US Government Accountability Office, the other one by the University of North Carolina, shows that about 12% of the water market in the US is private. Wow. And yeah, it is surprising. It's not a huge percentage, but we see that it may grow. And that's basically just like all P3s, out of necessity. We have an aging infrastructure that needs capital infusion. We are not able to get the public funds necessary to infuse this market. And so we will end up relying in part on private money to do it. Now, obviously the federal government itself was a little bit perturbed that they didn't have a handle on who was a player in this market. So the GAO produced just this past March a report entitled Private Water Utilities, Actions Needed to Enhance Ownership Data. So no one seems to have a really strong grasp on what private players are running this market. But, you know, we did some digging. We featured in the brief five publicly traded firms that are doing a lot of, and of course, these are clients of our member firms, but they are doing a lot of the private water work here in the US. Interestingly enough, two are large international companies based in Paris. So I thought that was very interesting. And you know, I think that's because Europe has a more advanced sort of private participation in some of this. water infrastructure. But, you know, EPA provided over $500 million in drinking water state revolving fund assistance to these for-profit utilities within the decade of January 2010 to 2020. Now, $500 million over a decade is not a huge amount of that EPA money, but it is interesting to know that these private for-profit utilities are able to get EPA money. As we see, more EPA money, if the infrastructure bill passes, may very well be directed towards these companies. And so I think it's important for us as an industry to recognize what percentage of water utilities are private clients and to make sure that, you know, regardless of the philosophical discussion of whether or not such a, you know, life safety component as healthy drinking water and other things, regardless of that, you know, it is certainly a growing market and it's a big client type for our member firms to focus on.
And they're treated like electric utilities, whereas they're if they want to raise prices, they have to go before a municipal board and give proof that they have a reason to do that, right?
Some of them, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, they're all different. Like any P3 arrangement, there seem to be all different kinds of contractual arrangements. You know, some of these private companies maybe just operate some of the facilities for municipal water organizations. Some of them, where I am right now in my pandemic home here in the Appalachians, besides the electric cooperative, I pay one of these five companies the water bill every month. And it is, you know, it was a community that decided they wanted, a lot of them are sort of small rural communities, maybe entire neighborhoods that decide that they want their own water utility. So, but they are not controlled by the community or by the public. They are controlled by, in large part, stockholders. And it was interesting to note that of these, we highlight the five largest publicly held water companies, but there are 14 of them that do a lot of work in the US. And in 2019, they were working in 33 states. So it's not just isolated to a couple parts of the country, it's actually all over.
And 12% of them of a pretty big market is a lot of right. money. So yeah, well, great. Well, I think that about wraps it up. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us about this.
Absolutely, thank you for having me.
Yeah. And so this has been the ACC Private Markets Update on the Engineering Influence Podcast. Thanks for listening.